And the
podcast
begins with a song of rebellion.
How can this
podcast
be my life?
CD Burners.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to CD Burners. Today, we are talking about Under Oath. They're only chasing safety.
Underwear.
They're only shitting safely.
Hello, capucha monkeys.
What is that?
It's a capucha. You don't know what a capucha
What's a
monkey?
Capucha monkey?
The capucha monkey is the...
It's from Indiana Jones or something?
Yeah, that and like Ross has one in Friends. They're the ones that you can kind of like train.
Should we get one?
They're awesome. They're the cool...
You should get one.
No.
That'd be fun for you.
It is like a me thing to have, be like, hey, what's up, guys? I have like a monkey.
You just like live with a monkey. Like it'd be like your roommate. I feel like it would fuck with you.
Yeah, they're the ones that you can teach to like steal.
I feel like feel like the monkey would bully you.
I feel like I like them because you can teach them to do a crime.
Mm.
You can teach them. They're like the ones that people in wherever they live natively, when people who are traveling to that country,
they're like, go steal that iPhone.
Yes. They're like, go take the wallet. And the people are like, oh my God, so cute. So cute.
Yeah. And then, like, ah!
Yeah, and then they just like
they
do it.
Ya.
Yeah. They're great. They're awesome. We should get one. I think you can legally own one.
You should get one in your apartment in Franklin Village. That'd be fun.
I wonder what the laws are. Anyway, we're talking about Under Oath, Only Chasing Safety.
This album was released June 15th, 2004. It sadly ended up, I mean, not sadly, it's still awesome, but it ended up at number 101 on Billboard.
So it didn't.
It didn't crack the top 100, you know? It's, like, so close. Like, it's a little bit disappointing.
I don't...
But it's still amazing.
...view any of those things as actual things. And, like, any of the numbers as anything. Like, they're just arbitrary to me. Like,
it was number 7 on the Christian Billboard charts.
Yeah, I mean, which is... We have some stuff to say about that. I mean, not now. I don't know. Are you going through numbers?
No, that's it.
Yeah, it was weird. Somebody actually asked me the other day because they were like, what podcast are you doing? I was like, I'm doing Under Oath. And they were like, I found it. So they're like, isn't that weird that like you would think that that style of music wouldn't be like the people who are very religious wouldn't be into that style of music? And I was like, I don't know. I mean, like as far as I know, it was really big. It was
I
like
found a quote from the producer, James Weissner, and he said, producing Under Oath, I remember hearing that blood-curdling screaming, and then to find out that screaming was for the Lord.
That's a great quote.
Mm-hmm.
I have a really great good quote from Spencer, but not about that, but I'll talk about it in a little bit. But I was just saying, I was like, you know, it's just like any other style of music. It's just in a complete, it's like in a category of its own. It's like Christian rap was really big. Remember like DC Talk?
No.
They were like the biggest like NSYNC like rap Christian thing, but we just never heard about it. Like, but they were like, they were the hugest. They were massive celebrities. One of my friends who now is like an incredible psychopath and does like OnlyFans and pulls his dick out all over the place and gets kicked out of every place he lives was in DC Talk.
Wow.
But he's wild shit on Facebook, like really wild shit. But he was in that group. And so what the thing is like, yeah, there's rap, there's like Christian rock, there's Christian country, there's all of the stuff. So why wouldn't there be
Christian metalcore?
Yeah. Like, and, you know, I think it's just different because metal is so heavily associated with
the devil.
Yeah. So I think that they were like, I don't understand. Why would they like that? And I'm like, I mean, you're just going to discount an entire group of people that like heavy music. And they're just like, we can't like that stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know.
This is technically, I mean, Under Oath is technically a Christian band. This album does have some themes of Christianity, but it's not necessarily like a Christian album per se. Like there are definitely some songs where there's like the ending song, like literally says, Jesus, I'm ready to go home. You know,
I think that there's a couple reasons why it was really cool, because it was like against the grain. They were doing like Warped Tour stuff being a Christian band. I think that inherently is like punk in itself.
Yeah.
To go out there and do this stuff while you have a entire group of people being like, that's lame. Like, that's not the cool thing to do. And I think that
they were taking chances and going out into the secular world and like doing Warped Tour stuff. Like, they weren't just playing like Cornerstone Festival or like any of those Christian festivals and staying within their realm. They were going out to the punk world. And yeah, that is punk.
It is cool. Like, it's
going
cool
against the grain.
It's really cool. Yeah. I mean, it's not like, you know, like I never listened to any of that stuff, but literally remember when we were doing that other podcast and the dude from that one band like is in the choir, like he is a pastor now.
Jason Lancaster from Mayday Parade.
Yeah. Like, all of the fucking Christian musicians are, like, for lack of better terms, God-tier musicians. Like, they're fucking awesome. All of that shit is so good. Every, like, pop song that's on the Christian charts, you know, if it wasn't strictly about, like, Jesus, it would be, like, they would be, like, number one hits. They are awesome and catchy, and they're so good. It's just the subject matter. They want to stay in their lane. And I think that, you know, I also didn't know what secular even meant until I was this meeting that I go to on Sunday nights. It's called like Secular Sundays.
Mm.
And I just went in and they do a different version of the meetings that I go to.
Right.
They do like a different thing. I didn't even know what it meant.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this album, like you said, is not so directly Christian. It's definitely spiritual, but they're not directly singing only about God. I found a quote from Spencer, and he said, a Christian band was singing about Jesus all the time, and we never did that. We were singing about life, the ups and downs and struggles we were going through. And Aaron had this to say. He said, we're Christians in a band, but not a Christian band.
Which I think that's a really smart way to look at it. And it was that's, I think, what differentiated them from other. Like, there's plenty of Christians in bands all over the place, you know? Like, they're all, but they, I think in this style of music, it stood out to be that. And that was like really, you know, that was taking a risk. And I really liked that about them now. I didn't even know it at the time. Like, it was all I knew about Under Oath. Actually, I did. I really loved this album. I really loved this album. And like, re-listening to it, I was like, oh, wow, it's wild that we are, you know, the earth is billions of years old and we exist in the same time and place where this album exists. I was like, how lucky are we? That rocks.
Yeah, it's a cool album. It's also the fourth album from Under Oath, which is interesting because this is like their seminal album. Like, this is their breakout album. And I think the other album that we're talking about later is the fourth album from that band too. So it's like bands that have been around for a while. But Under Oath was making a conscious decision here with this album to pivot away from the like really heavy metal core stuff that they were making before.
They were making like death metal before.
Yeah, death metal, and make it more post-hardcore and like screamo.
It was awesome. Did you listen to this stuff prior to this?
Oh, yeah.
It was fucking cool. It was awesome. Like, it was like very, it was metal.
Yeah, the album before this, I had a friend, my friend Gannon, he and I were really into Under Oath. He played in my screamo bands and stuff in high school, and he really liked the album before this, the Dallas Taylor album, but I could never get into it.
What I knew, how I got into them was that a lot of the guys that were a little bit older than me that played in hardcore bands loved Under Oath. They spoke about Under Oath like they were the coolest band in the world. Like, they really liked them, and they weren't, you know, they weren't religious bands by any means. All I remember is that I thought they were cool before I listened to them, because the people that I thought were cool,
they had cred already. So they listened to them.
Yeah. And then, you know, going back and doing all this stuff, like, you know, they were right. And the influence that this like Under Oath and this album in particular had on, you know, heavy music in general was pretty astronomical.
Yeah, I feel like we say with a lot of the albums that we've talked about, but this album, I think in particular, like, so many bands wanted to be Under Oath. They wanted to be Under Oath from this album. And I think it was also interesting when Under Oath put out Define the Great Line, like right after this album, they didn't just try to remake this album.
It was heavier. It was way heavier. Yeah. It was fucking cool. It was really cool.
And that
cool.
album is their biggest commercial success. Like, I think it came out at like number 7 on Billboard.
I like that they do that. And, you know, knowing the guys for, you know, I didn't know them before we started doing all this stuff. Like, what I know about Aaron and Spencer is that we just have make jokes and eat at steakhouses, you know, like that's yeah. like what I know. And like, you know, so going back and they never, you know, they've never spoken about all of these like accomplishments and all of the things that they've done, the things that they've influenced, and they've managed to stay, at least in my opinion, incredibly humble compared to what everybody says about them and what the internet says about them, which I think is a you know, maybe a testament to who, you know, why they are so big.
I mean, I know for a fact, just from talking to them and like their manager, and they're down to do everything. Like, they're down to do a whole bunch of different stuff. Like, they're down to do emo nights, but they can also fit on like literally like Knotfest if they wanted to.
Easily fit on Knotfest. Yeah, I mean, well, this album, you know, this differentiated from the other albums that they had and why they would even be in the word, you know, like why that would even come into play. Cause you listen to the albums before this and you're like,
yeah. So they made a conscious decision. Like, the Used was blowing up at the time. Taking Back Sunday was getting really big. And I think, you know, they had been at it for a minute. And they shifted out half the lineup. This album sometimes gets pigeonholed as, like, Spencer's first album. Like, I think Wikipedia just lists it as Spencer's first album. But when you dive in, like, literally half the band, this was their first album together.
Yeah, it was like a new band.
It's Spencer, Chamberlain, James Smith, and Grant Brandel. These were... This was the first album that they did with Under Oath. Spencer was in another band before this with his brother called Runs Through. Did you ever listen to that?
No, but
I listened to that. And Spencer sounds fucking amazing. Like, his vocals are fucking phenomenal. Like, he's just so good at screaming.
Yeah, he kicks ass. It's like how anybody that like wants to scream would want to scream.
It's the perfect scream.
It's really good.
And I guess, you know, he loved being in a band with his brother. Like, he called it his blood band. But at one point, like, you know, I think Under Oath asked him to join Under Oath twice.
And he said, no,
I'm doing Runs Through. And his brother sat him down and was like, dude, I don't really want to do music anymore. You are the best at what you do. I think you should join Under Oath.
That's actually one of the questions that I had for Spencer when we talked to them, was like what that process was like. I'm like interested to hear how that went, because, you know, he also was like, and why his reasonings for being like, I don't want to. And like, you know, cause it growth is like popping. Like, why wouldn't you?
They weren't popping at the time. They weren't popping before this album. They really were playing for fucking nobody. And then they, you know, did a tour with Spencer, and Aaron and Spencer started writing together. And Spencer had this to say about, writing with Aaron for the first time. He said he had to adapt to writing chorus sections because he didn't listen to many bands with choruses.
That's the quote I have from him. Yeah. It's the coolest quote.
Metal, probably
spazzed out hardcore that didn't have any of that shit. And I think that that's the coolest thing in the entire world, to be like, oh, wait, we have to have a song structure with a chorus.
Yeah.
To not know what that is and get used to it is so fucking cool. It's not something that I think you would think about when you listen to this album because of how melodic it is and the song structures. I think it's fucking awesome. And it's really like that's where the emo stuff came in, is in with these choruses. Like,
I had a quote here from Aaron, and he said that he learned how to write songs from listening to Dashboard Confessional. Aaron said, I was heavily influenced by Dashboard for writing. Dashboard taught me how to be a singer and weave melodies in and out of songs, but we made it heavy.
Speaking of that, right? There are emo influences on almost all of the songs on this album. They used Your New Aesthetic by Jimmy World as a template for a boy brushed red living in black and white. With Downset Go, the band attempted to emulate the style of Brand New's Deja Entendu. It went with I'm Content with Losing. They performed in the style of The Casket Lottery, which is, if you haven't listened to The Casket Lottery, they're really fucking good. And then, you know, some of the stuff is reminiscent of Copeland.
Yep, they did bring, I think they actually brought in Copeland vocalists for that last track to sing on there. They also, so they did a 4-hour live stream during COVID, and they sat down. Did you watch it?
I
watched a lot of it, but that's where all these like references come from, because they go through track by track and they like point out what the references are. One thing I was like, oh yeah, they fucking do sound like Refused.
Yeah, I mean, look.
Like the way that they incorporate all the electronic elements.
That was another thing. And a lot of the things on the internet, which I think in general, like it's a broad strokes. They're like, what? Why was this your favorite album? Why did it last the test of time? And a lot of people did say the electronic stuff, which I disagree with why this would be.
I don't think that's why you listen to this album. This album's good because a good song is a good song is a good song.
A good song is a good song is a good song.
These are incredible songs with really good structure, and they're clean, and the melodies are so memorable. The electronic elements are cool, and I think they were innovative for the time and for the genre. After this, there were so many bands that tried to incorporate like an auxiliary guy who played synths and like triggered the tracks and stuff.
Yeah. And they did it, you know, on a lot of the bands that we talk about on this podcast, their reasoning for doing that was to add to the song and not just to add to the track. Like they put it there with purpose. And like in another episode we're going to be doing, that's a common theme. And I think bands who are really, really smart, well, look, I understand it at the time. Like there were bands that I, you know, was playing with, they're like, we need a keyboard guy. And I actually unearthed like some stuff last night where I was like, oh, we added this because that was the thing at the time. And it really downgrades the song because you're adding it in to add it in. And I think these guys added it in to make the songs in a whole better. Yeah.
A lot of bands were literally looking for stuff for that person to do, just to have like a synth guy in their band.
I always wondered what the what that guy did like when those parts weren't happening.
He just like rocks out.
Yeah. Like what?
He does like the Kazo dance.
In any of the bands though, like I remember seeing Blood Brothers like in a weird fucking house, and all I remember the guy doing was going, then that first part that do, 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 and then like, that's it. And then just like shaking the keyboard. Like that's all I fucking remember. I also think it's really funny on Wikipedia. If you go on Wikipedia, it's like Spencer Chamberlain, unclean vocals.
Yeah.
Like I thought
it does say that it says it in the booklet.
It's really funny. Unclean is like a very funny way to be like, yeah, he screams.
Yeah.
Like it's just like a very, very like proper way to do that. And did they talk about on that live stream? Did you watch that live? How much did you watch that live stream?
A good amount. I clicked through it. I mean, I especially clicked through to the timestamps that they referenced on Wikipedia because I was like, I gotta know what the hell they were talking about when they were like, we referenced Brand New, you know? And then they're like laughing about it. They're like, this was bad. This was definitely us trying to do Deja Entendu and us being bad.
It's really cool. It's really cool to hear a band go back and talk about it and then listen to it. And you're like, I get it. I get what you were doing. And I think that's really an interesting. They also, dude, okay. A lot of these fucking, at the time, a lot of these reviews, right? They got compared. Yeah, they got compared to Hawthorne Heights.
Mm.
And I was like, bruh.
No.
No. Like, no. It also, this album got a lot of, like, people really liked it. People really fucked with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which was interesting and different and I think unexpected for something like this. And, you know, I couldn't compare it. And I think the only thing that, you know how I feel about that.
Yeah, this is miles above. Like the production, the songwriting, everything, the musicianship. This album is miles above.
I read some interview and watched some. They do a lot of interviews, which is great. Mm-hmm. Like there's some.
I know when we talk to them, we'd be like, I'm sure you're sick of talking about this.
I don't know if they are.
Like they do so much press. There was a lot to dig through.
Yeah, but they're fun though, is the thing.
And I like just talking to them anyway.
But. Yeah, they're fun. And it doesn't sound like canned answers. And I think that the thing is, I think we're going to have to come up with some
good questions.
Yeah. as opposed to like what else they have. Yeah. So like they did fuck their voices up doing this shit.
I saw that on the Wikipedia, but I didn't see any interviews where they talked about it. Did you?
No, I read something where they like Aaron got like throat tonsil diarrhea and yeah.
We'll ask him about that because I couldn't find anything to verify that. I'll run through a couple of the other like weird fast facts that they said on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
The band members paid rent to stay in James Windsor's house while they were recording the album.
Wait, what's the
Windsor's neighbor?
What's the hold on, what was his last name?
James Windsor.
Is that the producer?
Yes. Windsor's neighbor was a nurse that worked nights, and she, during the day when they were tracking this album, she would repeatedly knock on the walls because it was too loud. So they eventually switched the studio rooms and had to re-record half the guitars, probably because they didn't sound right or she was knocking and ruining the takes.
Yeah, I wonder if they still have like the knocking takes. That's cool. That's a cool thing to put out. That's a really
featuring
cool.
Knocks from the neighbor.
That's really funny.
The interlude song, The Blue Note, was made in 1 hour. Yeah, I could tell. Some Will Seek Forgiveness was written in half an hour, which, yeah, that's a good song. And then the cover artist, Chris McCadden, had his wife, Julie, model the cover.
Yeah, the dude was from bands called The Famine and Embodiment.
Did you listen to that?
I think along the lines, I've listened to The Famine. I don't know. It could sound entirely different, but like I thought, you know, probably interchange them with The Faint, which I think it was around the same situation, but I could be wrong. Could be fucking completely metal.
And then, so he had his wife step in and she's the lady on the cover and the band loved it. There were a couple of like alternate images. They had one that was like a backpack, like a hiking bag. I would love to see that, but they just saw this one and they were like, yeah, iconic.
It is. They nailed it. Like,
I love
it really
the packaging
is.
Too. Yeah, when you go in shit. And then you open it up and you're like, oh, shoot. Oh, God. Cam's going to clip this. All right. It's like she's got her eyes closed, open, closed, open, closed.
I didn't know there was a closed one. It's about as, like, honestly, it's about as iconic as, like, the Converge Jane Doe.
It's incredible.
Like, I've seen that.
This is good art.
That tattooed on people, but I've seen the Converge one is like all over the fucking place. If you have that, if you date a guy with a Converge tattoo, ladies, watch out.
I've never seen anybody with this tattoo.
I have.
Really?
Yeah. I've seen it with like the outline.
I bet
like,
there's some bad ones.
That? Yeah. There's fucking.
Like, this seems like a hard tattoo.
Yeah. And that's why it was. They're bad. They're bad tattoos. But I've seen a bunch of them, but they're usually like line outlines.
Mm.
Like, it's like you got to kind of know. I've seen ones that tried to be colored in too, and it just didn't fucking.
Finally, the band is going on a 20th anniversary tour of this album starting this September. And they're playing the album in its entirety, and then they're doing specific fan-voted sets for the rest of the show. So that'll be a fun tour for the boys.
I heard a... Well, also, like, I guess afterwards, I don't know if this was in that 5-hour interview, but, like, I guess Spencer, he re-listened to this after it came out and thought his vocals sounded dry, which I think it was, like, super critical.
They do sound dry, but it's, like, in a good way.
I mean, I guess. I don't know. I didn't pick up dry whatsoever.
He's an incredible
I think they
vocalist.
Both are. They Aaron both are. Is, like...
Dude, the fact that Aaron is playing drums and singing... And playing to a click track, like, that's wild. That's, like, how do you do that?
I don't know. And that's, like, the other thing is, like, if I could do that, I would just never stop talking about how good at music I am. Like, is the thing. And he's never mentioned it
once.
Never
once.
It's never come up. I would just never stop talking about it. And the fact that he's just, like, he's writing a lot of country. And he, like, has, you know, his other band.
Producer, writer.
Band, The Almost. Like, the dude is just a motherfucker of a musician in general.
Yeah.
It's just, and you can tell, like, I think that, you know, you listen to an album like this, regardless of if you like this style of music or not, you will be able to be like, oh, these guys are good at their jobs. They're good songwriters. This sounds really good. And I think that it really shows through. I'm just really, those two guys, you know, we know them pretty damn well, and they are, you know, really, really great people too. So another thing I really love, like this, they took the Bled out.
And I remember, yeah, they toured the Bled a bunch.
A lot. And Spencer really, really likes the Bled. Mm-hmm. And he like, there's a bunch of interviews with Spencer being like, those guys are fucking awesome. Like they're the best. They're the coolest.
They also, so this album actually came out 3 weeks apart from Three Cheers for Sweet Revenge. And they went out on the Taste of Chaos tour with My Chemical Romance, The Used, Under Oath, Senses Fail. That is where these Christian boys saw some shit, because this was like Bert at his worst.
Let's go.
Corrupting Gerard, like doing wild shit. Like I read a story about them crossing over the border to go into Toronto, and Bert had a bag of pills and he was like, I'm not going to throw it away. And he just took them all.
Yeah, awesome.
And then he was just fucking bananas, like talking to the guards. And yeah, these Christian guys were just like, damn, these guys are fucking wild.
Yeah, I mean, they were like living truly like rock stars. All the like all those guys were truly living like, you know, living that lifestyle. And it got caught up to Spencer, I guess.
But Under Oath, I think there was some, you know, they did try to keep their Christian values on the road, including leading Bible studies
at Warped Tour,
Yeah. So they would do these Bible studies every night. There's videos of these Bible studies, like Fuse covered it.
Yeah, I think like Haley is in some of them.
Oh, yeah, she was big, big Christy.
And then Fat Michael would come in.
So Fat Mike would, this was his shtick, he would like come into these Bible studies and just like try to fuck with the Christian guys. And like he would come in with a beer and they'd be like, okay, how can you be like drinking a beer? And like they would all have beer. And then Mike would be like, how come you're drinking beer if you're Christians? And they're like, dude, we can drink beer. There was a little bit of an issue that led to Under Oath almost breaking up forever on Warped Tour.
Okay,
this is because of Fat Michael.
Okay, I would love to hear that, because I heard that it's like that it got that rumor. I heard that was a rumor and it actually was
so
like not that bad. And they knew he was fucking around with them and it wasn't.
Here's what happened.
Okay.
Fat Mike fucking with the Christian guys loves to do that. I guess one night he offered Spencer Chamberlain cocaine and Spencer was like, nah, I'm good. I don't do that on tour or whatever. The next day, Fat Mike gets up on the microphone and it is disputed what he says, but he said something to the effect of like, you think Under Oath is a good Christian band? Well, I was doing cocaine with Spencer Chamberlain last night. I think he actually, this is where the rumor started. I think he actually said something of, I offered cocaine to Spencer last night and he said no, because he's such a good Christian. But the rumor mill started swirling around Warped Tour and it morphed into Spencer and Fat Mike were doing cocaine. The band confronted Spencer and they were like, bro, we heard you did cocaine with Fat Mike. And he was like, guys, like I did not do cocaine with Fat Mike. I've done cocaine before. I've done it when we're not on tour, but I didn't do it with Fat Mike. And they're like, you're a drug addict. You're fucked. You did cocaine. Like we're supposed to be good role models. And he's like, what are you talking about? Like, okay, even if I did have a problem, like you guys are supposed to be Christian and like help me. I think Spencer at one point thought that he had a problem and he went to the A&R at Solid State Records and also Christian label. And he was like, I think I would just need some help. Like I've been doing cocaine when I'm not on tour. And so he was like, oh, well, you got to get kicked out. You're done too. And then Spencer was like, what the fuck? Like, how is any of this Christian values at all? Like, you guys aren't supporting me whatsoever. You're like being self-righteous. Like there was this weird thing where like they've talked about it a few times. Like they said like, yeah, we were more conservative back then than we are now. Like we were maybe a little bit self-righteous and it took a lot for them to like work through that. Like they would say things, Buddy from Senses Fail, he was like, yeah, Under Oath would say things like, we don't hate gay people. We just don't approve of their lifestyle, like that kind of like Christian stuff. But eventually, Randy Nichols, Under Oath's longtime manager. He also managed like the starting line. Really great
guy.
We
like Randy.
He flew down to Florida like every week, and every week for like a month and a half, and would have one-on-ones with the band and be like, look, man, like how is turning your back on Spencer at all like the Christian thing to do? Like, can't you have some compassion for what he's going through? And eventually, like one by one, he won them back over, and Under Oath eventually got back together. But they did have to leave Warped Tour.
It reminds me of like when a kid smokes weed one time and his parents send him to rehab.
Yeah.
And they're like, you're a drug addict. And you get sent to rehab.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dude. And then you're in there with like everybody like nodding and fucking setting their pants on fire. Like when I went, and like, there was like five kids in there. They're like, I don't know why I'm here. Like, I don't know what's happening. Yeah. Like, I smoked weed once and my parents were like, you're a drug addict. You get out. To that point, like the guys, you know, I don't want to make it all about like their religion and the Christianity stuff, because it's not, you know, and that's not what this is about. This is about how sick the album is and like our thoughts on it and why it's so important. But I think, you know, the guys, they came around to just being good people. And I think that they were just like, oh, you know, some of the values here are good. Some of the values here are good. Let's just be good guys. And I think that that's where, when we, you know, we met them after, they were not a Christian band anymore. Yeah. And I think that it's definitely possible to still take some of the values of what you knew growing up and take the good ones and leave the ones that you don't agree with. And that's all part of growing up. And I think what really just happened was the guys grew up, and they grew up in a space that, you know, wasn't typical for a religious band to grow up in, and they grew up probably a lot quicker than some other people that might have left the church.
They were kids. They were like 20, and they're out there like on the road with fucking
Big Fat Mike
and Bert at his worst.
Yeah, that's fucking nuts, dude. I bet that was like absolutely so difficult. There's like two wolves inside of them. Yeah. But the like, I heard this really like good story, and it's so they weren't playing on really big stages back then, and they were causing fucking riots because of how gnarly they were. Do you know this story? Yeah. So they were causing like riots with how stoked people were about Under Oath. And, you know, they ended up like getting arrested in handcuffs, and they had never met Kevin before. And then like, that's how they met Kevin Lyman, was like they were in handcuffs and they caused a fucking riot.
And then the next year, they were on the main stage.
Dude, the fucking thing is like, every time we talk to Kevin, he has a story like this. Kevin has 8 billion stories of the coolest ways he's met everybody. And I don't have, I'm like, dude, I met him at the grocery store. Like, it's not like I don't have any of those.
He was out there fucking 40, 60 days a year, like in the summer touring.
Yeah, I guess his chances of
those, like that lifestyle that, You don't live that lifestyle of touring 60 days a year and like setting up a massive, massive show.
Yeah, I guess
I just
go to Gelson's
and come to the office.
Yeah, and that's how I meet people. Yeah, go to AA, meet people there. We were out on this past weekend, and we were at some event, and I knew so many people there, but not from the music.
You're like, how do I know
how
you?
How the fuck? It's like, see, it's really.
And then I see this guy get handed like a cup of water, and I'm like, that's how he knows him.
Yeah, and like I have to like put it together. Yeah, that's a really strange, because I'm like, fuck, dude, do I know this fucking dude? Do I know? I have to ask TJ all the time. I'm like, dude, do we know this guy? Have we met him in fucking like CAA office? Have we met him at like this office? Like, I don't fucking know. And then I come to find out that it's, you know, I hold hands. And now I am.
Didn't we hold hands once?
Yeah, we hold hands with guys meetings. But it's, you know, couldn't think of a cooler way to meet like Kevin Lyman.
Yeah.
Like, that's the coolest thing in the entire world.
All right. So what are your standout tracks from this album, Morgan?
Bruh. I do my best to not pick the fucking
The singles,
but I love Reinventing Your Exit.
That was the lead single from this album.
I think it's so fucking good.
I was in a screamo band, and like our first show, we played a battle of the bands at the Salt Lake City Library, and we covered that song. And there's a picture of me singing, wearing a white belt. Like, it couldn't be more. I actually have it. Hold on. I think I have it right here on my desktop.
So interesting you say that, because I fucking...
Do you have a pick?
No, I got sent all of these fucking songs last night, and there's like a hardcore. Is that you singing?
Yeah.
Show that better.
There's my passport. I don't want my passport to be seen. I have my notes. But yeah, there's me.
That's so cool. You look just like the press photo. And that's Gannon. You look just like the press photo.
Photo. Iconic. Yeah, that was our blueprint. That was the blueprint for everybody.
That's
my girl
so
cool. pants, my white jeans. Like, this is so like stereotypical.
It's a really good picture. That's a good picture.
I'm gonna send it to Slack to see what the class thinks.
And then I really liked I Don't Feel Very Receptive Today. I picked those two. I really like this album in whole. I also like that they did like the interlude stuff. I think that's cool. You know,
whether, the blue
like,
note.
Nobody fucking. You know, it's like you just got to listen through it mm-hmm. to the other song. But I think it's cool that
I love Dangerous Business. I think that song's really fun. That's the one with the choir.
Yep.
I guess they like did some sort of shenanigans to get this church choir on the album, and then they felt really guilty about it. I think.
Why did the church choir like not know that they were going to be on like a metal album?
Right. Yeah. We can ask for the backstory on that. But there was something where like they weren't fully truthful about it. And then they were like, we're going to go to hell. But that's cool that they did that.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
I remember, like, I would blast this album, and then it would be so funny. Like, you'd be at, like, a red light, and you'd be, like, trying to, like, flex, and you're listening to Dangerous Business, and it's, like, this metal song, and then all of a sudden it just drops into this choir. Drowning in my
sleep. Yeah, it's awesome.
And everybody's like, what the fuck?
We should fucking actually, you want to know what? That's a clean choir, right?
Ooh, yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, we should take that. Dude, we're DJs now. That's how we think, you know? You really got to take the songs apart. Think about it like that.
Do you have any, if you like this, you might like that?
Yeah, I do. Coalesce. That was one of the bands that, another one of the bands that all the older kids really liked that I instantly liked before I listened to them. Obviously, The Blood. Botch, another band that like all the older kids liked.
Botch.
Botch is awesome. Kill Sadie. Did like really, if you like, you know, these are like old guy hardcore bands, like really in, like, I think this might be like very influential to them. I don't know if it was like around the same time as this, probably a little bit earlier than them. But yeah, listen to those bands, Blood, Botch, Coalesce, Kill Sadie.
I put Bring Me the Horizon, Sempiternal, because they use a lot of electronic stuff and it's like kind of heavy too.
Simp Eternal? Simp Eternal?
Yeah, Sandpit Turtle. That's what people, that's like the joke on the internet.
Is that a band?
Simp Eternal.
That's a band?
No, it's the name of the album by Bring Me the Horizon.
Okay, I didn't know that was a band. I like all the Bring Me Horizon stuff, all new stuff that everybody's mad at. I like
Bring Me an Undereath just put out a song.
I think it's sick. It's also their most like played song on Spotify.
It is.
Yeah.
All right, motherfuckers.
Oh, wow.
That is about it. You got anything else to say?
No, just the fact that this was like TJ said, I think it was like a blueprint for a lot of kids that wanted to play in bands that sounded like this. I also think it was like, I'm also not a very huge fan of labeling music as something, and this gets thrown around as metalcore, or it's just, you know, it is just a good heavy album. Like, I think that that's a good way to put it. And I get so annoyed when people like try to micro categorize these
micro genre.
Like, it's fucking annoying, dude.
It's hard. I mean, now learning about all the sub micro genres in electronic too. I get it.
It's just like so annoying because
that's why the press just like so lazily puts emo as a label on everything, because it's kind of just, you know, a real easy way to get like a emotional punk influenced music into one category.
I hate the press.
Yeah.
I hate the press. I hate reviews.
Fake news.
It is fake news. All this shit sucks.
The crooked media.
It is. Seriously, Pitchfork is the crooked media. All right.
Stay tuned for our interview with Aaron and Spencer from Under Oath.
That's going to be good. They're so good.
Bye.
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 Well, guys, we had an awesome time listening to They're Only Chasing Safety and doing a deep dive and watch. You guys have done a shit ton of press, so it's going to be really hard to ask you things that you didn't cover in interviews or in the 4.5-hour live stream you did on this album. It made for a great episode. We already did our episode, and I was like, I wish we had this much information to work with on all of the albums that we do, because it just made it really fun, like hearing all about like the influences and the things that you guys brought into this record. But we will try to ask you some questions that maybe you haven't been asked before, but at this point I feel like you've talked about Chasing Safety for forever.
I'm going to start this out with a fucking blanket statement, considering you guys did that insane 5-hour live stream deep diving into every single song. What the fuck have you guys not said about this album that hasn't been said? What's going on with this, or your thoughts about this that you guys already haven't said?
So it's not blanket gone, but that's also why people like people's first records more. And that's why we'll never live Chasing Safety down, when I think we make way better music now. But our fans, the majority of them, will never believe that. And I don't think they should, because they're right, kind of. You know what I mean?
It's interesting that you're calling this the first record, too, because it wasn't the first Under Oath record. But I like that you're saying like it felt like a first record because it was a new band.
It is the first
record. I can speak to that because I was there. You know, like, we were really for this album. And we've never talked about this either, but we had kicked our first frontman out of the band, and we had 3 shows. Like, we sort of just like did little regional things, and we had 3 shows left on our calendar that we had to fulfill, and we had kicked our other singer out, and we didn't know what to do. So at the time, Chris and Spencer were dating friends, and so Chris knew Spencer, and Spencer was in another band with his brother, and Chris was like, "Hey, will you fill in on some shows?" And Spencer shows up to practice, and I'll never forget this. This is the day that Spencer and I became soulmates. He showed up to practice, stood right beside me, and we wrote songs off Chasing Safety. I don't know that we ever practiced the songs that we were supposed to. We somehow played these shows, but that's how the album started to be made. Is it just had to be. It was like the 6 of us had to make those songs. Like, there was no option. We were supposed to be together, you know, playing our final 3 shows.
Do you guys remember what the first song was that you wrote together?
We had had the bones of Reinventing Your Exit, where I was just singing those parts. And I think that it was that, but it could have been something else. I don't remember. In my head, it's Reinventing Your Exit, because we had that. Do you remember, though, that we had, I had that melody, and there was no response or whatever. And in my head, it was Reinventing Your Exit, but that might be a lie. I don't know.
I remember, like, the first songs we wrote. I know, like, there was 2 songs in the works when I came in the room, which was Reinventing Your Exit, I'm Content With Losing. Which is probably why those 2 songs have maybe the least amount of my vocal on them, because they were kind of started before
I don't remember. I don't remember. I'm Content With Losing.
The front half was worse, but the rest, I think I really want to say that, like, we kind of started with Young and Aspiring, but I could be wrong. And I remember Dangerous Business came way later. I remember Receptive.
I told you I might lie.
Receptive came way later.
This is the podcast of misinformation, you guys. So,
I feel like it was Reinventing Your Exit, and I know that Dangerous Business was way later. But I don't know. But the point of me saying that is, like, we kind of fell in love quick, and to this day, I don't know if I've ever said this either. To this day, Spencer's never joined the band, because he wouldn't give us an answer. We kept trying to get him to be in the band. And I remember this, we were doing, and he wasn't going to do it. And he was, because he was in a band with his brother, and the whole thing. And he's still, you've never officially joined the band.
Well,
I don't think.
I mean, there's paperwork, but yeah, I was never like, I guess like, I'll never forget the time of Tim sitting me down and telling me that this is not a weekend thing, that we're going to do it. Like, we're going to tour and like give up everything. He's like, are you willing to not have a car and not have an apartment and all this stuff? And I was like, yeah, I got nothing else to do. Like, this is what I wanted to do. I was already, you know, kind of doing this anyway, just with different people. But I remember when Chris asked me the first time if I wanted to join the band, I said no, because this sounds terrible to say, but the demos were so bad. The first demos were so bad that I couldn't believe it. And Aaron, you can remember this, because they're like the guitar tones from that Razor session and everything. It was just like shockingly bad, to where I was like, look, I'm stoked to play, but I don't like the direction. Like, I didn't like the direction they were going.
I love shockingly bad. Shockingly bad sucks so bad.
It was like, I was so confused on what they were trying to go for. But what ended up happening was just really bad demos. And really, and you know, like, everyone, the longer you've been in the music industry, you learn that demos can be shit if the song is still good. But, like, I couldn't get around a dude in a band that was like bigger than my band, because we were both Florida bands, you know, like it was Under Oath, and this band I was in was called This Runs Through, and we were signed and doing shows, and Under Oath was doing shows, but bigger than us. And I remember Chris showing me these demos of like, hey, you want to join our band? And me being like fucking blown away by the trash that I was like, I don't know if I do. No, I don't know. But then it was like, honestly, it was getting in the room with them, and like, because I was always in bands with people that were older than me, and like, yeah, Grant and James were older than me, but not like as old as the guys that I was playing with. So it was like playing with people my own age, which I'd never done. Like, even in high school, I was always in bands with kids that were older than me. Just from having older brothers, that's kind of how it's always been for me. And I get in a room with these guys that are like-minded in my age, give or take, and then like we start ripping, and I'm like, I'm normally the guy in the band like pulling all the weight, you know, like I have to write all the guitar, and then I have to get on vocals, and I have to tell the drummer what to do. And I get in this room with these guys that all fucking ripped, and I was like, everything leading up to that first practice for that first show, I was like, yeah, I'm just gonna fill in for these shows and you know, keep going along with life or whatever. But when I got in the room with, it was especially Tim and Aaron, feeling that like, oh, these guys are like me, not saying that I'm the shit or anything, but I was just used to being the guy in the room that had to keep everyone on track or on task, or like, hey, we're going to do this, let's go over it again, that wasn't good enough, or like, it didn't feel right. And I walk into a room with people, like, immediately it felt good. And I had never experienced that. And
dude, I think that that's like a really, I get that very much, to be like, walk, to be like, oh, we are, I can rely on you just as much as you can rely on me, instead of having to like really pull it. Dude, you actually, Spencer, you said out of all of these fucking things that we've done, you said the coolest quote, and I don't know if you remember this quote, but it is the coolest quote out of any band that we have done so far, is that you didn't listen to bands with choruses, which is the sickest thing that anybody has ever said to before joining a band.
Well, at this point, I mean, when I was a kid, I loved Nirvana and Alice in Chains and Soundgarden and all this shit. At the time of writing music as a child in high school, there was a movement of the scene that was underground. This is pre-bands like us being on Warped Tour. You got to think, like, we all went through a phase growing up listening to bands that were all full of choruses. But I guess as a kid, you don't think of it like that. You just think Nirvana rips, and you think Soundgarden's cool, and Alice in Chains is fucking awesome. Nine Inch Nails is cool.
We didn't make songs like that then.
No.
You got to remember, too, we're dating ourselves and saying how old we are, but like – and it's, I feel like I used to listen to interviews of older band guys, and I cringe when I hear myself back sometimes now, but it's just true. Things are the reverse now as they were then. And what I mean by that is bands have to write quotation finger banger songs to get on playlists to get listened to. Back then, and the money's reversed. So back then it was super expensive to record music, like fucking expensive. Like to make a demo was thousands and thousands of dollars. And now it costs nothing to record music. And then bands aren't good live because their demos are so good that they don't have to learn to play together, and it's all tracks and it's in ears and it's the thing. But back then it was flipped. So he was talking about our demos sucking. Yeah, he was talking about our demos sucking, and they did because we couldn't afford to make good ones. But when you got in the room, we all got in the room, it ripped. And that's the chorus thing too, because you chased the way that it made your balls and guts feel. You didn't care about, is this singable?
We didn't even use the word chorus back then. We just had parts. Like, and maybe that's why some of songs are untraditionally structured. But like I said earlier in the interview, like we had no fucking clue what we were doing. We just wanted it to sound cool. And like, even when like saying that we didn't listen to choruses, like when clearly Nirvana and all that shit was my favorite bands, I didn't consider that a chorus. It's just like, this is just awesome.
You just considered it you're just like, this is sick.
A song. Yeah. And like, so when we were writing, when Under Oath is writing songs, we just wanted it to feel good. So it's like, after pummeling someone with yelling and screaming, like there should be a release here. What's the release? Oh, my knuckles have turned to white, or whatever it was. There needed to be a push and pull release. And we didn't even call it a chorus, I don't think, until years later. Because
I wish now that, like, I live in Nashville, you know, and I make 5 songs a week for other people. And I wish that I had some of that, like, you know, wistful wonder that we had then. You know, because now I feel like I know all this stuff, and like, I hate what I'm about to say. I hate it so much, but like, I know how to make songs for TikTok and shit. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like I know the algorithmic sound, you know what I mean? Like,
you're like, I know the formula and
it's a science. It's a business now. And
we didn't have that. Like, we didn't know.
Thank God. Right?
Yeah, and I honestly, you know, and I think that's something that people, you know, people herald They're Only Chasing Safety and talk about it, but we didn't know. And I think that's the greatest way to open it and to start this conversation, is we truly didn't know. None of us are – we can't take credit for it in a way, in the sense of like, you guys wrote these songs, and I've heard people say shit like this. It defined the genre, and like, you know, all this like real big worded bullshit, and that's kind, and I'm so grateful that people think that. And but the truth of the matter is like, there was no plan of that at all. And I think that great things, like things that move me, are never made when there's a plan. Do you know what I mean? Like, like, I can sit down today and write a song that is algorithmically sound for TikTok, and I promise it won't matter like those songs did. I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah, Aaron, stuff won't matter in a couple of years, you know?
Aaron, or even a couple of days. I want to bring it back to something that you said about bands translating their demos to live performances, because this album has incredible production, and obviously, like, you do so many. You're the heartbeat of this. Like, you're playing tracks, you're singing, you're drumming. How did you guys go about translating how these records sound to playing it live? Like, that's incredible that you're even able to do all those things at the same time. And like, what was that learning curve like?
Yeah, you're an insane person, dude.
Thanks. I feel like I'm going to cringe when I listen to this.
Don't listen to it.
Like, we don't fuck around. Like, is the best thing I can say. Like, I mean, I'm being serious. Like, we didn't fuck around, because you couldn't. Like, you had to be good. And what I mean by that is, like,
Bands couldn't get signed if you had to be seen, and like someone had to see you and hear you or talk about you to get anywhere.
This like was when like, we were kids, there'd be local shows and you would hear about a person in a band. Like, oh, dude, like this singer is insane. Or like, mm-hmm. You got to see this drummer, you know, or this bass. And you would go to see, it wasn't about like, what are they going to do on stage? Or have you heard their new shit? Like, it's popping off on TikTok. No. You went because you heard that somebody in the band or the band was good. So for us, we wanted our records to sound amazing, and then we wanted to be amazing live, and you just do it. You just do the work that is required to be wonderful live. And I think that's the art that's lost, because the live thing now doesn't move the needle. It does for us because that's been our business the whole time. But like, if you start a new band today and you make a bunch of banger tracks in your friend's house in LA, and then you get signed and you make a dope video and then it's all over TikTok, you probably aren't good live because you haven't had to do it. Mm-hmm, you know what I mean? Like it, and we just put in the reps, man. That's it. Like, cool. I have such a trust with these people that like I know that Spencer will rip in 2 weeks at a show. I don't give a fuck about a rehearsal. I don't give a fuck about like thinking about it. I just know it. And if he doesn't, I'll make fun of him. And to be honest, I know that sounds insane, but that's the school we come from. Do you know what I mean? Like,
there's two things, dude. Especially like, look, you guys are some of my favorite people to talk to, because I feel like you talk the way that I do, where I can't listen back to my shit because it's so cringe, because it's how I feel in the moment. And it is the truth. Like, it's the truth about how I feel. Like, you said things, you're like, I just want to make shit that rips and is cool and fucking rocks. It's not like a eloquent put together answer for press. And that's what I've always respected that about you guys. Also, you said something that people go to see people, like they see these people. And then you said bass. And I said, nobody has ever gone anywhere to see a bass player. But that is
not true. That's not true.
Okay, I'm just kidding. Spencer, I'm kidding. But that is actually how
Primus was real, guys.
So also said like this, like I people go to see people, and that's the truth, because I was there, because I grew up in Tucson with a band called The Bled. And I remember
That band was so good. I forgot about them till you just said it. Fuck.
I remember them. I thought you guys were larger than life without ever hearing, seeing, knowing anything about you because of the way that they spoke about you guys.
Oh yeah, they were sweet guys. We did a lot of early shows with them back in the day before it all connected and clicked. But going back to what you said to Aaron, like asking about like making it good live, like how did you guys do that and how did you pull all this off? And back to what he said, was it was about reps and about you had to play good live. You had to be a good live band. And the reason, and I think the biggest shift in Under Oath's career was from Chasing Safety to Define the Great Line. And I think that's because we were more violent and aggressive. If you went and saw Under Oath during the setup to Only Chasing Safety, through the touring cycle of Chasing Safety, we were still playing. A lot of people say they were there, and they fucking weren't, because it was 500 cap rooms. And I know people fucking lie, and they weren't there until Define the Great Line came out and after. But during that time, we were like jumping off cabinets, breaking guitars, jumping through drum sets. It was violence, and it was good live because that's what we were good at. And that's where the shift came, because some guy that had good gear and a good ear recorded us on the Only Chasing Safety and made it sound more polished and better than what we'd ever sounded like, which has helped the career for sure. But we were like, no, that doesn't really sound like us. So let's make something that sounds like us, which is what spawned 2 years later to Define the Great Line, and probably writing it within 6 months of Chasing Safety coming out, because we were proud of it, but it also was like, it didn't capture what we were doing live. we were good enough to record it that way, but we were even better live. And I know that sounds cocky, but going back to the people that didn't see it then, it was like, dude, this was before Aaron was on a click track. And now it sounds closer to the record than it did back then. And back then I would say it was probably better. Not that we've gotten worse live, but we've gotten more professional live, and it sounds like the record now. But back then in the early days, it sounded like Dillinger Escape Plan with fucking choruses. It was bananas. We were playing a million miles per hour. One of us was bleeding or throwing up, and we were diving in the crowd every 5 seconds. And that's what was exciting, and that's what built our career. And now looking back at it, it's like, yeah, the record still stands and people still love it. But at the time we were going, well, this is what people are attracted to. This is what people are buying into. We didn't know anything about what was going on because we weren't on the internet. And the people that were had to be, you know, we didn't have laptops. We were fucking touring in a van. We were,
dude, I feel like I can't get over the idea of like when I was a boy, that's what it feels like. And it's so weird to blink your eyes, like we were talking about at the beginning of the conversation, like in 20 years has gone by and it's changed so much that and what I'm about to say is really awful and I kind of mean it. Like being in a band now, I wouldn't wish it on myself. I don't think I could do it. Like starting a band now is what I'm saying. I don't think I could do it. Like, and there's so much, and I work with new artists like every day and I love the hunger and some of them are so talented, but it's just such a different landscape to where the stuff we're talking about of like that raw, untethered, untenable, like feeling and the way that we played shows and made music is not allowed anymore. And I think obviously, and you know, in some towns and in some city, like there's resurgence of it that I probably don't know about. And, you know, I don't want to, don't at me somebody, but like what I am saying is like, if you come out and sounded like we did then, you're fucked because we played too fast. We were out of breath all the time. And now because your demos are so fucking good, you have to play your first show with an in-ear rig and like
and a tracks. Proof
and tracks yeah. and shit. Like, we didn't know you could purchase those things. We didn't know, I'm being serious, we didn't know they existed. Like, so we saw a video. This is the reason we started playing with a click track. We saw a video of ourselves. This is like in 2005. And we were like, oh my God. Like, we're playing a different song. It's so fast because we're so amped up and there's people, you know, like, and it was just so different, you know? And I think that that's, I don't think we're capable of recreating that record because it's 2024. And I know that people want to hear it again. And, but it's just, it's over. You know what I mean? Like that in music, it's over.
I think that people don't know what they want. And that's what, when you give them what they want, they're not happy with that either. Like, it's about changing everything all the time. I mean, if you made that now, no one would fucking care. It's been done and it's been done better. It's been done 1,000 more times. And there's, you know what I mean? Like, you don't go back, you go forward. And we're lucky that we were a part of a special time and a special moment. And it, you know, we've had more special moments since then. So
what I can tell you is this, like, so Aaron, basically what you said right before this is kind of why I think that our scene was the last thing and why it's lasted so long and why people are so gravitated towards it is because we had to look for it. We had to go and do it. It wasn't just presented to us. We couldn't change our identity every day because of something that we saw on the internet. We had to really, really chase it. And like,
and it was fucking yours. Dude, it was yours.
It's like we had to find our friend group. We had to find the people that liked the things that we liked. We couldn't just DM somebody that lives on the other side of the entire world and be friends with them instantly. Like, this was something that we had to go and do and grow up with. And I don't know if you can recreate that. I agree with you 100,000%.
I was just thinking about this too, trying to find things that haven't been talked about Chasing Safety. Spencer and I were so untested and unproven, like in the studio. And we went in with James Wisner to make this record, who had just had this massive success with The Places You've Come to Fear the Most for Dashboard. And he was like a real ball buster in the studio. Like one of those people that's like, do it again, do it again. And Spencer and I just burned all the way out in the studio. Like we couldn't sing anymore. And we had, this is how flipped everything was in those days. We had to go on the road. So we had to leave and we couldn't finish. Like we couldn't finish the album because we couldn't sing. Because he was one of those people like doing a vocal for a song took like 7 or 8 hours, which is not a thing anymore, by the way. But back then it was. And I remember I had blisters in my throat and Spencer sounded like a frog. It was a disaster. And we were so accustomed to the live aspect of life. They sent us on tour and we went on tour and sang our balls off and then came back and had to do the vocals.
We finished it.
Fast and fresh because we were so accustomed to just yelling things out live that like the super focused granular studio, we didn't even, it hurt us both so bad. And of course you grow and now that's not an issue, but then we had never done things like 35 times. Like that's not something you didn't demo your song in your room with auto-tune and then go cut vocals. Like we were on stage. So we just we had to go get better by playing shows, like heal from being in the studio. It was the strangest. It just was such a foreign. So no one knows that. I think there's a good amount of vocals. Like we had gotten demos for the later songs on their Only Chasing Safety. And I think some of our vocals on like Dangerous Business and maybe a few other songs are from the demos even, because we just couldn't, like the super granular producer vocal thing, we couldn't even do it. Like we just were like, what? You want me to do it again and again and again? I was like, we couldn't even talk. It was wild. So I think, I don't know what songs, I know for a fact Dangerous Business is not from the studio. It's from like our buddy's place in Atlanta. We went to do, I'm pretty sure.
Well, we ended up recording with him most of our records after.
Yeah, after that we ended up using, but he did some demos for like the later songs that, and we wanted to put those, I wish we had those. I did a deep dive recently on some like horrible hard drive with a bad daughter board and trying to find those demos. But I think some of those, you know, that we had coerced somehow the label into paying for some demos. And I think some of the vocals on Chasing Safety, I know Dangerous Business, and I'm not sure what else, are 100% demo vocals. Cause we were so green that like, you know, we couldn't, you know, and I have a studio here in Nashville and people come in every day and they have no album out and they can just sing in the studio for hours because that's how they learned. Like it's like the whole thing is the opposite of how it was when we started. It's a different music. Is a different creature now, which is, I'm not being like, but
we can't fight it. We have to go with it, but we can recognize it. Like I think it would be fucking crazy of us to like be like we're gonna deny technology and we're gonna deny the way that how we're moving forward. That would just, I don't know if it would be beneficial to us, but I always just recognize it. I go, well, this is not gonna be the same, but it's gonna be different and we might have a different experience, but it's not gonna be like how it was.
You know, these songs too, like I hear them now and there's like this earnestness in them and like this hunger in them that you can't, that I don't, we'll never get back, you know, and us trying to would be gross too, you know? So it's like, and I think that's why the emo thing is so comfortable and welcoming and it's big too, but like, there's a reason why an emo night feels the way that it does. And I think the biggest reason is because a lot of these songs, I was thinking about this the other day. I was at emo night in Sacramento at Ace of Spades. And I had like time to kill. And I was sitting in the back And at Ace of Spades, there's no like backstage entrance. You just walk on stage to get to the dressing room. It's like the weirdest thing. But I was sitting back there and I couldn't leave. You know, there was like 300 people on stage and I just was in there. And I was thinking, like, all the songs that really popped at Emo Night that night were from the band's first records. Do you know what I mean? Like, it, you know, like most of the big pops that night, like the big bangers that night, were from the band's album ones. You know what I mean?
Yeah, the breakthroughs.
It's super interesting. And I think that that's something that we can never get again. And I think that that's why Emo Night will always exist, and this conversation will always exist, is because you can't go back and recreate something that wasn't created. It was just birthed. Does that make sense? Like, it wasn't designed.
It makes the most sense. It wasn't designed.
You know?
No, it's like, I mean, that's like I was saying, is like, we're never, this, that was the time before all of this stuff. We can't get back that, you know, that even the people that are making music today, are they have different ways of doing it and ways of feeling and ways of growing up that when we were growing up, that will never be the same. And that was a certain time and place that we'll never get back. And that's why I think that even 20 years later, I still wake up and I have memories about 20 years ago. And I don't have memories about like fucking what I did a couple days ago, because it doesn't fucking matter. Like, I'm just like, it's so quick. And
I mean, I think we all would have killed to have the opportunity to just release things like you can now. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, look at Post Malone went to bed, no one, and woke up famous. That's literally the White Iverson story. That's what happened. Like, he went to put it on SoundCloud, went to bed, and woke up a star. I wish that existed when I was a kid, because I would have taken advantage of it. And then I don't at the same time. You know what I mean? Like, they're only chasing safety. Like, it was our foray into doing this professionally that we didn't know was going to be. Like, we didn't mean for it to be, and we didn't know it was going to be. It seemed impossible that we would ever be in a professional band. You know what I mean?
Like, there wasn't a lot of money behind it. It's not like a lot of, and even some of the bands from our scene that popped off came from major labels. Like, there was someone behind it with lots of money that had an idea. And this was right before that any of this shit was cool. Like, you sounded like this on Warped Tour, you were made fun of and bullied and called names that we can't say out loud anymore. Like,
yeah, I can say
you know, yeah. You know, like, this was not no plan of being big. This was just kids. Like, we had some small time label that was stoked to give us enough money to make some records, because we were doing cool shit live. Because we were part of the scene, and the scene was underground, VFW halls, basement shows, invite only fucking flyers. And it was a movement, and we were just a part of it. We were lucky to be a part of it. But it was exciting. Like, you know, but there was no big plan for this to pop off. And I think even some of the bands in our scene, their first record, that was the plan. You know, like, there was some big wig major label guy that heard this potential. We were just in the middle of it, and it worked, because we were just doing whatever the fuck we wanted. And I think not enough people do that anymore. Like, do what the fuck you want. Do what sounds cool to you, man. Stop trying to fit in with everyone, or do what's cool on TikTok, or do what's cool on the radio, or
dude, it's
Octane.
There was no cyclical nature of music.
Yeah, all
then.
That shit.
Like, it was just, like, now there's such a cycle. Things are like, I live in Nashville, like I said before, and it's so fucking crazy. Everyone wants to be country right now. And 2 years ago, everyone wanted to be pop punk. And 2 years before that, everyone was a rapper. Like, it just does this thing. And because we didn't have all the availability like we do now, back then that was going on in some way, but it was in your own bubble. So there was these pockets of movement, you know what I mean? And we were just really, really lucky to be in one that worked. Like, I think that's what it really boils down to. You know what I mean?
Yeah, the scene, and I think the scene that is kind of gone now it blew up when Warped Tour accepted it, and it became more acceptable when Hot Topic and all these like MTV2 started playing the videos, and it was okay to dress this way and look this way. But I think the reason why stuff like Emo Night still works so well is because it still gives you the feeling of what it felt like to be a part of the scene. Like, because that scene is kind of blown out into radio rock and massive festivals and bands headlining with pyro and 30-foot LED walls, you know, like, but there was something to be said about the party of when the scene started and everyone was jumping off stage and everyone's all over each other and you're just having a good time. And I think that's honestly why what you guys do works so well, because the scene is, that feeling is missing. Like, we're talking about genre this and record that, but really what the fuel in the gas tank for Under Oath was, there was a scene. You were called a scene band or a scene kid for a reason, and that scene is gone because it blurred into the mainstream, which has helped us all, including you guys. But the scene was a very, like you were talking about, like you couldn't DM someone and get along with someone on the other side of the world. The scene was your family, and it was a feeling. And that's really what the fuel in the gas tank for Under Oath was and why it blew up. And that's why Emo Night still exists, because it still makes you feel like that. And it'd be a young kid going to Emo Night that never experienced it when it happened, getting to experience it for the first time, or a guy our age going like, man, that's what shit used to feel like. And that's so
That's awesome. Sick. That open stage thing is a big piece of that too, because, you know, there used to be just – a big piece of the Chasing Safety thing was like everybody was always all over each other.
I don't know if you remember, but I had to pull Tim aside when you guys were setting up at Emo Night, and I was like, dude, you can't leave your laptop on the stage. Like, it's gonna get fucked up. And he was like, what are you talking about, dude? And I was like, I promise you, you're going to be happy that you took the laptop with you.
yeah. I mean, but you guys are really the only thing going that's doing that feeling of like the, and
well,
that's
kind of not in the electronic world now. It's like become a thing to do the 360 stage, and we were looking at it the other day. We were like, we've been doing this forever.
they call it
something different. They call it a 360 stage, and I was like, oh, this is just what we do. It's like a thing that they like advertise, but we're like, oh,
even like main stage on EDC now, they open up the back of it and like people can go hang out on stage.
Really?
Because I think, it just started happening
like this year.
Dude, because people are trying to get that feeling of being like, dude, that's all over. You guys know it. Like, that's all over each other. Like, you just are disgusting, like sweat from the ceiling, dripping from the ceiling.
Yeah.
Like, those are the moments that, like, I remember. You know, those are the moments, not like me being in a like, very air conditioned, comfortable club watching somebody play perfectly.
Yeah. You guys should somehow try to like copyright it and then sue some EDM people or something.
Well, guys, it has been so awesome chatting with you as always.
It's always good.
Like we could just hang and bullshit for hours, which we will have to do here in a couple months whenever we see you again. I know we were talking about hanging in Vegas and doing Bumps of Caviar again.
Dude.
But I want to just ask one sort of like last question, because you're about to go on this big 20-year tour of playing this album front to back. And when it was announced, I remember Spencer and I exchanged DMs and you said something to me. You were like, thanks, man. Like, I'm glad this album means so much to you and that you're excited about it. But like, it's going to be a little bit weird for me to be playing songs I wrote when I was 20. How do you guys feel now playing these songs? I know you've said sonically maybe it's the best these songs have sounded live, but like taking yourself back to songs that you self-admittedly wrote when you were boys that you're going to be playing on the road for the next few months, how does that feel?
Honestly, the saving grace for us, okay, so it's not about us anymore with those songs. It's about what the fans feel and giving it, you feel it from them, you know? But honestly, the saving grace for the tour for us is the reason why I said that to you, TJ, is because we had just finished our brand new record when you texted me that. So it's like, we feel more proud and more stoked about anything we've ever done right now. It's in our back pocket. No one's heard a sound but us. And then we got to go out there and play the record we wrote when we were like 18, 19 years old.
Yeah.
But the exciting thing is we're playing as many songs before the record, I mean, after the record is done. Like, we're playing fan voted encore set from every song available that we've written. So that's exciting. And you know, it is hard to play songs you wrote when you were a boy. Like, I don't connect to anything off this record anymore, personally. It was a whole different lifetime. I mean, it was before the drugs, before addiction, before depression, before all the things that I went through that made me the man I am now. Chasing Safety is just a bunch of boys trying to make some cool sounds and make cool noise. So it's hard to get up there and play songs you're like, I have no personal connection to this whatsoever anymore, but it's not about me. Like, I can play a song off Define the Great Line and cry because it was really personal and we were going through stuff. I play a song off Define the Great Line, I can cry because I see the guy in the crowd literally singing at the top of his lungs and it really means something to him right now. And I'm like, that's how we do it. It's like, you just got to look outward, not inward on those songs. And that's not a diss to the record. That's just a product of writing songs when you were a kid and playing them when you're an adult.
I mean, if you look at a real big band, you know, like U2, for instance, and like when he's with or without you, and he's singing that song for the umpteenth time that came out in the 80s, and there's somebody out there that just lost somebody, and they're just fucking. It's the outward thing, like Speak said, you know, like it's. I don't relate to talking about some girl that I was thinking about when I was 19 years old. I'm 41 years old with two children and a vasectomy. You know what I mean? Like, I have no, but when I see a person in the front row hugging their buddy and they've been drinking and they got a fucking t-shirt over their shoulder. And then I'm like, oh, I remember now. Like, it, to me, it's a little different because it creates this memory. Like, you're singing this with me because you feel that way now, and I remember how I felt then, and now it's symbiotic, and now it's one thing, and now I feel it, and I mean it, too, like I did then. But, you know, right now, it's like, I don't even know. Some of those songs, in ways, can be funny to me if I listen to them now. Like, lyrically, it can be funny.
Some of them, yeah. We talk about it a lot on the bus. Like, it's cringy to us.
I mean, I remember on the live stream there were parts where like you guys are like hiding your face like during certain songs.
Think about having your high school senior year self blasted all over the internet right now. Like at your age now, you'd be like, "Fuck," you know. But I'm proud and stand by everything we did and still do. Like, I know everything we did at every time, be it Chasing Safety, Define the Great Line, Lost, all the way up into the new record that's going to come out next year. It's the best version of us at that specific moment in time. And when we were 18, 19 years old, writing those songs and putting them out when we were 20, that's the best version of us at that time. And you can't be too embarrassed about that. I mean, we've grown a lot and we're way better than we were and we're men now, but like that's a part of our journey and it's a part of our story now, and you can't turn your back on it, and so let's go fucking celebrate it and then we can move on and do something else, you know. Like, and those songs will always be there and we'll always play those songs. Every tour we'll be playing songs off every record we've ever done. But if it's 20 years of Chasing Safety, let's go fucking get it and celebrate it, man, and then we can do something else. You know?
Hell yeah, bitch.
That's fucking it will be so fun.
Dude, you guys are the best, but for real, like, I mean what I said, like, in the beginning, I didn't know a lot of the stuff about you guys, and it's really, you know, for TJ and I, it's really honored to be your friends.
We love you both. We love you.
Yeah, we're so proud to know you guys, and I think that like I feel in a way like you guys are in a band that was just behind ours. So it's like I just want you guys to win, and I think that the torch has passed, you know, and you have the torch now, and now you help us do things. And I think that's the way that I want it to be. You know what I mean? Like with new bands. I feel like you guys are a newer band, not a new band, but a newer band. And now you're helping us. You know, I always like to see, like, you know, we appreciate it and we love y'all. And
yeah, we love it, man. We all feel each other. You know, like, Emo Night is a huge reason why a lot of these bands are having resurgences now. Even the bands that stood against it when it started are like, one hand feeds the other. Like, if we're all celebrating a genre or a music, like, it's a win for everyone. If Hawthorne Heights has a comeback right now and their song smashes at radio, bands like Seosin win, or Under Oath, like, you know, like any of us winning now is a win for everyone, because everyone's celebrating this music, new and old. Like, a new fucking A Day to Remember song smashing is great for old songs too, like, in for every band, you know, in the genre. Like, it all feeds itself. It feeds each other, and I love that. And I love that you all are winning. And I think it's important.
You guys are like, you guys are like real DJs now, though. Like, at the Zook show, I was like, that's your own thing. Like, that thing is. Are you guys gonna do that before?
We're doing it on Friday, so you'll have to come by. We'll go grab a Carver steak again.
I can't wait.
We'll be there.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll be there.
Awesome.
Be there.
All right, stay on for just a second. And you guys, thank you so much again for being on this podcast with us. It was truly an honor to talk to you about this album
so
and
fun.
To listen to it again. And we'll see you both soon.